ago when I was last here with you. We were in the midst of dealing with what's called the Aaronic blessing, as if Aaron came up with this blessing. And it's not. It's Yahweh's blessing. And we turned to it because our good friend Kirk was disappointed by how ludicrously erroneous the English translations were of this, and how it was routinely cited as probably the single most quoted line from the Torah in Christian churches, and yet they didn't get any part of it completely right, and most of it they got completely wrong. And so we spent some time in Numbers, which is Bamidbar, in the wilderness, trying to determine, and this is the sixth chapter beginning at 22, this 22nd statement, trying to figure out what God actually did say, and then use this as an opportunity, not just to communicate what God had to tell us, which is really profound in this particular case. There are so many useful insights, which is why I want to turn back to it, because we didn't complete it. And there were some marvelous insights from God regarding what he was saying. And that's the most important part. But also we used it for two other reasons, one of which was that what I would like to do is to play a role as a facilitator in helping folks develop a affinity for translating Yahweh's testimony for themselves, and to provide the tools that make that possible, to walk folks through the process, to demystify it, if you will, so that it's encouraged. People can have a conversation with Yahweh all on their own, which is a marvelous experience, and come to understand what God is saying. And the other thing was that Kirk has in particular, has been introducing us to how, even without a lexicon, if you look at the Hebrew letters that comprise the Hebrew alphabet, of which the words in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms were originally scribed, and you go from the Babylonian Hebrew characters that are in the Masoretic, back to the original Paleo or ancient Hebrew alphabet. Same language, different alphabet. And you look at those letters, and by the way, different alphabet, the letters had very similar names. They had very similar pronunciations. They just had very different shapes. It's far more different than, for example, a cursive letter is in English versus a printed letter. You know, if you print versus cursive writing. Now, I understand that most people don't do any either now. That if they want to send a note, they text it. If they want to send a letter, they email it. And most everything we write now comes from a computerized font. But in Hebrew, Yahweh's font, if you will, were pictographic letters that had a very clear depiction of what God was trying to communicate. So we have the ability, and we have Kirk on the line here, to not only investigate the meaning of these words so that we know what Yahweh was offering and communicating and teaching, but we also have this whole process of trying to demystify translation, so that more people are encouraged to do it. Hello, Kirk. How are you?
Good morning. Welcome back. Everybody,
yes.
Good to see you.
Great, yeah, boy, I get great report, Scott. And had such a marvelous time doing those two shows with you. Thank you.
Well, I found out I'm a better caller in than a caller outer. So I'm.
That was not the report that. That was certainly not the report that I was given.
Well, people are awfully kind. I tell you, Scott is really good. You're going to have to
see him. Yeah, he is.
Even though he's cringing, I'm telling you, he's really sharp.
Yeah, he is. There's no question. He is. He could probably do a better job of this program with either of us. Yes. I would like to turn to the individual who is the ultimate communicator, who definitely can out shine and out communicate all of us combined. That would be Yahweh. And what he had to say in a book that we very seldom consider. I mean, the Torah we consider all the time, but the book in the Torah that's the least considered happens to be the one from which this statement comes from, and it is Numbers, or Bah Midbar, in the wilderness, beginning at 622. And I know that during those two shows with Scott, you spent a lot of time talking about the errant names and titles that are being ascribed to Yahweh. This begins by Yahweh reminding us that he has a name, that he has given us his name, and that he himself uses his name, and that he wants us to use his name.
Right.
It begins, Wah Yahweh. Now, in Hebrew, what does the Wah mean?
It means and, usually, or is to start something. Or
right. That's its function in grammar. It is a conjunction that that is used to connect things together and to begin a new statement. It's used like that all the time. But the Y itself is drawn how, Kirk?
It's a tent peg, or like a Y. Mm-hmm. If you're just looking at it.
And the tent peg, now, this language, the pictographs here, were used to convey important meaning to people who, without the depiction of the characterization of what these letters represent in the words that they were forming, would not have otherwise been able to understand them. But someone could look at this, could observe the letter Y as a tent peg, and back 3,500 years ago, what would they have thought the tent peg represents?
Well, I always think of it as two things. It's obviously is to enlarge or increase or add more room to the tent, but also to secure it, to make it strong.
Have you ever been to a Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus when they actually had it? Have you ever gone to it in a large tent or ever gone to any large tent meeting?
Sure, like in the old days, sure.
Yeah, and if you go to a large tent meeting, what you find is that the really large tents, the thing that is most amazing is the strong men that it takes with sledgehammer pounding enormous tent pegs, spikes. You know, these spikes can be 6-8 feet long, 2 inches in diameter of steel. And they're using sledgehammers to pound them into the ground. It's the single most important aspect of creating a large tent.
Right.
So without a extraordinarily secure tent peg, you can't have a large tent. Now, you can have a small, I do a fair amount of backpacking, you can have a small two-person tent that you can just open up, and you don't even have to have your tent pegs where the wind's not howling. And so long as you're in it, it's not going to blow away. If you're not in it, then you better have your tent pegs or it will blow away. But if you want to have a large tent, you can't have a large tent without tent pegs. And so it's the very thing that enables there to be an enlargement of a home, which is what the tent represented. It was a home. And the other thing, as you've already said, it makes the home more secure. The more, the larger, the better the tent peg is installed, the more secure the home is from falling down or blowing away. Mm-hmm. So that's what it means. And therefore denotes the idea of making a connection that increases and makes something secure. And it's not something nebulous.
No.
Those who first saw this language would only think of one thing that was being enlarged and made more secure by the tent peg.
And that would be the family home.
That is correct.
Or the major, their home tent.
That is correct.
Bedouins, yeah.
That is correct. That's all they would have think. And so, you know, while we can expand on our analysis based upon what we have learned and the tools that are available to us today. We always ought to begin at the place that God began. And since he began using these pictographs in communicating to people who lived in tents, we ought to begin there. That was how he scribed his message. And so however we elaborate on this from there is fine, but you've got to start at the beginning. And so we should always view the law as the increasing the size of and the security of a home. So this is Yahweh. So who's the one that is making the home secure and increasing its size?
Of course, it's Yahweh.
Right. And in Yahweh's name, do we find any attributes that can be associated with family?
Yes, we have. We also have in his name. We have the two. We have him reaching down.
Right.
We have two family members, and amazingly, there's a Yah right in the middle of them.
Boy, isn't that interesting?
Wow, brother.
Right. Yeah, there's a wall. There's a tent peg right in the middle of Yahweh's name. And you might, you know, I can tell you that, you know, I am prone to being stupid. I'm stupid a lot. I mean, I miss a lot of stuff. And I will tell you that I was always perplexed. But come on. And I get the two people standing up, reaching up to you. I understand the arm reaching down and out with an open hand. Man, that all resonates. But why did you put a wimpy old law in your name? Why would you put a tent peg in your name? And the reason is obvious. What's Yahweh's intent?
Enlarge the family.
And make it secure.
Right.
Make his family secure.
Certainly.
Protect his family and have his family grow. And so what letter would be better in his name than that?
Well, I looked over the list. It's probably, I can't think of anything.
No. And you could put in his name the Be'eth, which is the family home. But the existence of the family home is one thing. What the law says is that I'm increasing the size of my family, I'm making my family more secure, and I'm empowering those who are in my family and making them secure. It describes the very mission. It describes the very purpose of the universe, the purpose of the Torah, the purpose of life, why we humans exist. It's a marvelous letter, and it's in the midst of Yahweh's name, you're right. Right in the middle of the two people that represent the covenant. Welcome back to Generalness. We're having a conversation with Yahweh and with one of his children, an adult child, and Kirk, another adult child, and here in Yada, about the very basis of Yahweh's name. And we find this statement begins, "And Yahweh," and the "and" means for the purpose of increasing and securing a family, Yahweh. And we find that Yahweh has this same letter in the midst of his name and right between the two people that are standing and reaching up to him. So if you were looking at that from the perspective of those who first saw the Torah written down, how would you interpret two people standing, reaching up, looking up, and a tent peg between them?
Well, you would come to the same conclusion that we know is they're talking about increasing the family, because
yeah.
they would also understand the hay being a female as well, a male and a female.
Yeah. Yeah, protecting the family. The first hay is masculine. The second one, a hay at the end of a word, almost always makes that as a noun. It would make it feminine. Like Ben is son, Bena is daughter. And so that's how they would have seen it. They would have seen it as the man and the woman. They would have known in the story that the most important story in the Torah by far is the story of Abraham and Sarah becoming the mother and father of the first child of the covenant, Yishak, laughter, and of Yishak giving birth to Jacob, who is named Yisrael and becomes the father of the 12 tribes of Yisrael, the chosen people. And so that's what they would have seen. They would have seen Abraham and Sarah depicted in Yahweh's name with the tent peg between them, knowing that they're being increased, they're being empowered, they're being made secure, they're being protected in a family. And, of course, there's only one way to interpret an arm reaching down and out with an open hand in the context of a family.
Yes.
And that's of a parent reaching down to lift the children up, right?
Yeah.
And we find the two people standing up, don't we? We find them benefiting from that result.
Engaged in looking up and reaching up, yes.
Right.
He's reaching down. So it's, you know, even if you had to explain it to somebody the first time, they'd get it forever. I mean, it's not like they it would be complicated.
You and I share a kinship with and a friendship with Larry. And Larry's, you know, all of us have our own proclivities, things that that really resonate with us. With you, it's the graphic nature of the letters that that comprise the words in Hebrew and understanding their meaning. And with Larry, it's the realization that Yahweh isn't the least bit religious and that he is anti-religious. When you look at how Yahweh chose to write his name, and my guess is he knows how to write it and knows how to spell it, and that since he came up with this alphabet, that he chose it for a reason. When you see the characters that comprise his name and two people standing up, not kneeling down, and him reaching down to lift us up and make us secure, it's impossible to see a religious deity, isn't it?
Yeah, it's correct. I mean, it's,
and that's Larry's big claim, is that Yahweh is not a religious deity. And his name, once you understand the characters that comprise his name and what they convey, that's the only rational and reasoned conclusion.
Yeah, you can't get there from here.
Yeah, you just can't get there from here. You know, if he was a religious deity, what you'd find is a clenched fist, and you'd find the two people down on their knees.
Absolutely.
Heads down, you know, begging
face
for
down.
Mercy.
Yeah.
Right?
Face down.
Absolutely. You'd find what you find in religion, people bowing their heads face down, kneeling in front of the depiction of the religious deity.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you would find if God was in fact religious, but he's not.
Well, that's
dead.
The picture. That's all the artist always depicts on our knees, praying up to something, you know, or kneeling down or something.
Yeah.
So the imagery is certainly out there, and he didn't choose it.
Right. In this statement that we've been analyzing, it uses the two Hebrew words for communicate and word multiple times in it. They are Dabar and Amar. Let's deal with the first one first because it's the next word here. It's the verb. And Dabar can be both a verb and a noun. As a noun, Dabar means word or statement. And as a verb, it means to speak using words and statements. So, would we have any way of knowing the full context of Dabar and its purpose, the word, the spoken word, by looking at the letters?
Well, we have awfully good clues. You going to go to commercial or?
Yeah, we'll go to commercial, but it's D-B-R. And when we return, we're going to consider what those three letters convey. And what the purpose, therefore, of Yahweh's word actually is, using the very letters that he created and that Yahusha affirmed. So we begin with Yahweh, and we move to the verb Dabar. So there's three letters in Dabar, which is the Hebrew word for speak, to say, to communicate, as a verb and as word and statement as a noun. First of all, that's just interesting in and of itself, isn't it, Kirk? That in Hebrew, nouns are defined by the action form. The action form of in a language is a verb. I mean, all a verb is an action form. It depicts an action, where the noun depicts a thing.
Right.
But in Hebrew, almost every noun is defined by its verbal or actionable form.
Yes, I've discovered that.
Yeah, and then it's kind of interesting that that you have a language that is action-oriented.
Right.
The focus of the language is on activity.
Right.
Now, why do you think that might be?
Well, it's because you can't have a relationship if you're not engaged.
Right.
And it's all about the relationship.
That God wants us to engage. He wants us to do stuff together.
Right.
Yeah. There's so many people that get hung up on observe, as if they think that observe means to keep, as in to obey.
Right.
And they think that Yahweh's statements and his 10 statements are commandments to obey, when it's 10 devarim, 10 words, 10 statements.
All right. Yeah. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, and they go so far in our translations to change the Hebrew word, which means to listen, which is an active thing, to obey.
Right.
And yet that's not it at all. It's to engage. You know, observing is something that you can actually do, that you are participating in.
Well, commandments have a tendency to paralyze one. I mean, it's a paralyzing thing when you're starting to obey everything and you're scared to move.
Right. Do you have any freedom in the military if you're ordered to do something?
No. Well, you have the freedom to get shot if you don't.
Yeah. If a senior officer commands you to do something, if he issues a command, that's an order, a command.
Mm-hmm.
What are your options?
You either refuse it and get in real serious trouble one way or the other,
yeah,
or you go do it, and most of the time you're going to obey the order and go.
Right.
Or do whatever.
And so it's not commands are counterproductive if you're creating a relationship, if you're creating a family, if you're trying to encourage joint contribution and participation, the last thing you'd want is an order. If free will mattered to you, you wouldn't have orders.
Exactly.
You wouldn't have commands.
No.
The funny thing is, Yahweh doesn't have any. So what we have is a language that's based upon activity, because God doesn't want us to be, bowing down to him and bumps on the log. He wants us engaged. When you have a family, Do you enjoy, a family when and a marriage when you're doing things together, or is it more fun when just everybody is just sitting there and staring off into space?
Well, of course.
Yeah. So it's an action. So Devar as an actionable concept, what are the three letters and what do they convey?
Well, you have this starts out with the delete, which is the D sound, and of course that's a doorway, an entranceway, and then the second letter is a bet, which is the family home, the tent. Once again, the depiction of the tent, and it's followed by the rosh, which is the R sound. So you have a DVR, and the head is the a person's head where you're engaged in the senses. You can look, you can hear, you can think. You know, so you have basically the word comes to the it's all about the family and the engaged individual, I guess is the easiest way to say it.
Yeah. Yeah, the person paying attention, who is engaged being observant,
mm-hmm,
who is listening to what Yahweh has to say, who is paying attention to what Yahweh has to say, who is reading and thinking about what Yahweh has to say and responding to him, that individual is being invited into through the doorway into Yahweh's home to become part of his family. And that is the sole purpose. That's the actionable aspect of the Word of God.
And that you can't get a command out of that, out of words.
No, and how many Christians, carry up their Bibles and say, this is the inerrant Word of God? How many Christians do you think know the basis of the Hebrew word for word?
I doubt there's, unless it's just someone who, oh, God, half of one of one of one of one, how many zeros can you put in front of
it? Yeah, yeah. This is the statement from the Torah, of course, which is where the Devar, the Word of God, is introduced to us, telling you that Yahweh is offering to make you secure, to increase you, to empower you as part of his family. He is He is offering those who pay attention to what he has to say, who consider what he has to say, the opportunity to walk through the door to become part of his family and live in his home. I don't think any of them have a clue.
No,
but that's what the word means.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't have got there as a Christian, no.
No, you wouldn't have. You only get there if you are the letter R in Hebrew, the resh, if you are observant, right?
Right.
So here is Yahweh. And Yahweh, he elected to speak the eternal word to influence. Now, we could have just said, and Yahweh spoke. But this was written with the third person masculine pronoun as a prefix to speak. So, and Yahweh, he elected to speak. Now, you could eliminate the he if you wanted to, because the subject here is clearly Yahweh, but it's reinforced by the fact that it is that the verb was given a prefix that says, and Yahweh, he himself. I mean, it really is the probably the way we communicate this in English, and Yahweh, he himself elected.
Right.
To speak the eternal word to influence. Now, I've added to speak, elected, eternal word, and influence, where your English translation probably would have, and the Lord spoke. Now, is there, first of all, is there a way a religious publication of a Bible could determine whether or not this was past, present, or future tense?
Well, it would exist. It would exist eternally. So,
yeah, the answer is, of course, no.
Time.
Yeah, there is no tense in terms of limiting in time Hebrew. So you have to throw that out the window. If you're going to convey this correctly in Hebrew, you've got to convey it in a way that tells you this is true throughout time. Now, if Yahweh's communication was limited to a specific point in time and limited in duration to Moshe, would he have used the perfect or the imperfect?
He would have used perfect.
Correct. But this was written in the imperfect. Which means that this statement is eternal, that his communication is everlasting, without end. The imperfect never ends.
Right.
That's all it means. So, don't you think that you have really two choices here if you're trying to communicate what God said? You can choose to ignore the fact that some verbs are written in the imperfect and perfect, some limited in scope and time, and some representing an ongoing activity, some a completed activity, the other is an ongoing activity. You can choose just to ignore it and say, it probably doesn't mean anything today. We don't know why it's there. Let's just pretend it doesn't exist. Or you can actually try to convey its meaning. Don't you think that if God put it there, we ought to at least consider why he conveyed it?
Casual. He's certainly isn't casual about what he has.
No, he's not casual about this stuff. He's very relaxed and approachable. But when it comes to his testimony, he said, don't change a jot or a tittle, didn't he?
Yes, sir.
So, wasn't it the jots and the tittles that were used to convey this imperfect and perfect?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, we ought to pay attention to them. So, this is the eternal word, ongoing. Now, I also said that he elected to speak. He chose to speak.
Yes.
It was his desire to speak. And I said that because this was written in the Jusuf. And the Jusuf is an expression of volition. And so, when you're dealing with volition, you know, what you're dealing with is someone's desire, someone's choice, someone's will, someone's wish, someone's decision. So, once again, we, since the Jusuf was conveyed using jots and tittles,
mm-hmm.
and Yosha said, don't think that I came to abolish the Torah or anything in it, that that all of the jots and tittles, all of the letters and strokes of the letters that comprise the Hebrew alphabet will continue to be in full effect throughout the Torah, so long as the heavens and earth exist. So it strikes me that we would be violating what he said is instruction if we ignored the fact that this was scribed in the Joseph.
All right.
Now, Kirk, I know you're... I'm not a grammatarian, and I know you're not one either.
You're talking to the wrong one here.
Yeah. And what I've tried to emphasize, and I want to reemphasize, this is not a lesson in Hebrew grammar.
No.
When I tell you that verbs in Hebrew are not stuck in time, that they're true forever, mm-hmm. that's not a lesson in grammar. That's a lesson in perspective.
Yeah, understanding. Absolutely.
Right. It gives you the proper perspective of who Yahweh is and what his word represents. It's not stuck in time. It's eternal in time. And when I say that many Hebrew verbs are ascribed a mood, and that the mood is almost exclusively volitional, and when you're dealing with volition, you're dealing with will, desire, choice, and decision. Why is that grammar? Isn't that the very basis of relationship and of free will and of choice?
Well, yes, and it allows those of us who read this to understand what went into the translation so we can trust it even more, you know, because right. we can look those things up and say, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and we'll consider stems when we return, because they're not grammatical either, they're relational. So here we have, and Yahweh, he elected to speak the eternal word to influence. And we have this written as Dabar, which we have the verb is the doorway to the home and family for an observant person. And what we have is that this was written in the P.O. who is listening to this program, who says, oh my God, peel, stem, that's part of grammar. I don't like grammar. I'm not comfortable with grammar. I don't even like English grammar. How in the world am I going to understand Hebrew grammar? But the stems in Hebrew really have nothing to do with grammar. They have everything to do with relationships. Every peel, every stem in Hebrew establishes the nature of the relationship between the parties in the sentence. You know, the parties in the sentence are typically a subject and an object. The subject here, the person doing the speaking, is Yahweh. The object here is the name that follows, which is Moshe. So it's just establishing a relationship between Yahweh and Moshe. And there's a variety of different relationships that can be established, which is why there's a variety of different stems. This pill stem is indicative of one of those kinds of relationships between the speaker and the person being spoken to. And in the pill stem, what you find is that Yahweh is influencing Moshe by putting him into action. It's like if you get in your car and you drive your car, you're influencing where the car goes and what the car does because you're involved with that car. And Yahweh is influencing Moshe. He's involved with Moshe. Moshe is going to be put into action based upon the will of Yahweh. That's what it means. It's not complicated, right?
Not too hard so far.
No, it's not hard. And it was... Then if we continue on, we find that, in fact, I said the Joseph here, and I should not. It's the imperfect walk consecutive. And the consecutive is a volitional mood. It just means that the person who is speaking is conveying their will. It's what they want. So, you know, if you want to know what God's will is, it is for his word to influence you to action.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Yahweh Dabar means in the consecutive form, is that Yahweh's word is designed to influence you to act. And, of course, the word was written as the doorway to the family home for the observant person. So do you have to be a rocket scientist to figure out what the will of Yahweh is in terms of what action he is trying to encourage?
You might shamar his word so that you become part of the family.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I mean, in Debar, with the three letters, there's an actionable concept and two things that are being identified. The actionable concept is the person's head with their eyes, their ears, and their mind and their mouth. Somebody who can use their eyes to be observant, use their ears to listen, use their brains to process what they have observed, what they have heard, and then to respond. That's the actionable aspect. And the other thing is the doorway into the family home of Yahweh. So that's what he's, that's what he wants. Yeah, it is. And we're laughing here, but the idea here is to communicate. This is not hard, folks. It's a very simple concept that if your perspective is right, that you know that this is the eternal word of God, that it's not stuck in time, that this is not an Old Testament as in past tense, and that there is no New Testament as in something that replaced that which was old. That Yahweh's testimony is eternal. His word is eternal. He conveys it in a manner using the imperfect that says this is ongoing and eternal. And he states things in a way that's, that are expressing his will so we can know it. I personally want to know what God's will is.
Sure.
And God's will, Yahweh's will for Kirk's life is for you to be observant so that you enter through the doorway and become part of his family.
Correct.
Doesn't get better than that, does it?
No, I don't know how anybody could get anything else.
No. And, you know, we have just begun. We haven't even come to the blessing itself.
Oh,
and we've already been blessed, haven't we?
Oh, yeah.
Kirk, I want to thank you not only for the two shows this past week, but for today. May God bless you all.